Profile Interview.
13 minutes after 9 o'clock, Johnson A is my guest, Brajon. It's so good.
What's up, fella?
You have no idea how good it is to have you on the show. I've been watching your career. I've been listening to some of the things that you've been saying, some of your TED Talks. Let me say that you have contributed a lot to my education. And you don't even know. You don't even know it, though, do you?
What a great intro, man. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
I really appreciate your work. But, so the reason why you and I are having this conversation is to introduce not only you to our listeners, but your thoughts, your ideas to our listeners. You're a future strategist. What does that mean?
That's right. Well, if you look at it closely, it's a plural future and futures strategist. And the reason for that is that there are multiple futures. And we don't realize, but many people think that there's always one future, but there isn't. There's a limitless options of futures. And we need to be able to ascertain which ones we want and build towards them. I think there's an invisible cloak of victimhood amongst global humanity that is almost like victim of the future. They're uncertain of it. It's scary. But really, when it's a blank canvas like it is right now, I couldn't find anything more exciting. So that's my mission in life, is try and get people to see it as something exciting rather than something scary.
That in itself is a very revolutionary idea, that there are multiple futures, right? But because... Yes. I am Aubrey, and I'm one Aubrey. I imagine that there is only one future. What do you mean that there are multiple futures? And what gives them their multiplicity when I'm only one individual?
Well, great question. Look, here's the thing. Is that our future is a replication of our memories and our stories that we drag with us. And we realize that the more familiar our past is, the more predictable our future becomes. And so the whole point of this multiple futures is that you have the opportunity to change your future by healing your past. And so this is on a very individual level, because let me ask you this. Don't you know some people that make money no matter what's going on in the economy? And some people never make money no matter what's going on in the economy.
So a couple of years ago when I was a lighty, right, I used to love watching, what was Blake Carrington's movie again?
Blake Carrington
was a big sort of businessman in this movie. What was it? Anyway, it was one of those big soapies. You know, remember Dallas and
yes, this, of course I know Blake Carrington.
Yeah, remember that
beautiful black hair.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Dynasty.
Bold and beautiful, wasn't
Dynasty.
It?
No, it's called Dynasty. So in one scene. He is having an argument with somebody and he says, listen, take everything away from me right now. Take everything away from me right now. In 3 months' time, he says, I will be a millionaire. Mm. Right? And I absolutely agree with you that there are some people that just have a particular mindset that is indomitable, regardless of what the circumstances are, that they are the circumstance almost. Yeah.
But you understand that what I'm saying is, because if you're a victim of what's coming, you've already started on a back foot. And so, and let me explain why I've got into this place is that, you know, when I started my career, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago, I was always very excited to tell organizations about the future. And I would tell them what was coming and how exciting it was. And I've come back to that same organization, which was very excited at my presentation and strategy sessions, and it changed absolutely nothing. And I started to realize that it wasn't really about showing people what's coming, but what's stopping them from changing their behavior. Mm. And that really is the crux of my work, is that if you don't change your behavior, what do you expect is going to happen in the future? The same as the past. So if we want to evolve and we want to create something new, the responsibility lies squarely on us. And with quantum science now proving that the world is not happening to us, but through us, the world is echoing back to us what we are believing and what we are expecting, this becomes a combination that I call modern wisdom. It's the combination of ancient truths that, you know, ancient societies and cultures have been telling us for the longest time, which now science is starting to prove, combined with future strategies, with business ideas. And when you can combine these two, you become really powerful and very dangerous. In other words, you can create and become an architect of what you actually want to do.
What's the difference between knowledge and wisdom, John?
Knowledge is, wisdom is practiced knowledge. So what we have is we have a lot of clever people in the world. We don't have enough wise people in the world. Let me explain that. You know, the world that we live in right now has been creating the same type of person over and over and over. And our education system around the world is very similar to all the subjects that we study around the world. And so what has happened is that we've created a surplus society of similar people with similar degrees working at similar companies creating similar products. And that is knowledge. That's very clever. That's high IQ. But what has happened is that all those positions have become commoditized because, you know, if you don't like your job, there's 15 people behind you waiting for it. You know what I mean? So It's not exactly like that is what's going to get you to the next place. Wisdom is going to get you to the next place. And so what is wisdom? Alan Watts has a great saying. He says, the knowledgeable man has to learn something new every day, but the wise man has to unlearn something new every day. And it's almost this wisdom that will get us to become more prepared for an uncertain future, because the future is incredibly uncertain. And so when you're trying to apply the old ideas, your old intelligence, your old knowledge into this new world, you're going to find yourself frustrated. And so there has to be an unraveling to ravel again, an unlearning to learn again.
Give us a call on 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567. My guest is John Sonnet. He's a best-selling author. He's a global trend specialist. And I'm having a conversation about his work, his thoughts, and I'd love for you to be a part of the conversation because I think he is onto something here, that perhaps it's not so much what you know, but how you apply what you know in the appropriate way given the circumstance or context that you find yourself. Do you find, John, that perhaps we tend to hamstring ourselves as individuals, as organizations, as communities, as the globe, as humanity, in that we sometimes think that because I have a certain set of skills or a certain set of credentials that makes me qualified? I mean, it's a conversation I have a lot with my listeners. I call it credentialism. That people walk around with certificates and pieces of paper that say I have passed these a number of tests, and therefore I am qualified. We need to look at that a little bit more carefully.
Look, it used to be enough. It really did. It used to be, because if you got those degrees in the past, you were kind of guaranteed of some certainty of some career. Today, it doesn't have that. But also, let's remember is that many people have created an identity to do with their degrees and to do with their pasts. They can't let go of that. And because of that, you're hamstrung in not being able to recreate. So you hold on for dear life to your old ideas, fighting and screaming that the world is changing too quickly, rather than letting go to reskill yourself. And that's a tough thing, because you know what? You paid a lot of money. You spent hours, if not months and years, developing those degrees. But what has happened in the world today is we've moved from this industrial linear world to a dynamic quantum world. Where we used to be in a complicated world, now we're in a complex one. And let me unpack this for you and that'll make a little bit more sense. A complicated world is a world where you have patterns that repeat themselves. This is why you could use an Excel spreadsheet, a CA, and a mathematician to extrapolate last year into next year with minor adjustments. Because you had an idea of what was coming, you know, it was all predictable. We've now moved into a complex world. And a complex world, the fundamental difference is that we have patterns that don't repeat themselves. And so now what you have is you've got this idea of economies of scale, of efficiency over everything else to be able to create profitability. But the truth is, in a complex world, how are you preparing with efficiency? Usually you're preparing with something totally different.
Yeah.
And so let me land this example for you. When you go to the airport, when you put your suitcase on the conveyor belt, that conveyor belt gets you your suitcase onto the plane in the most complicated, repeated pattern process and automated way possible. There's hardly any humans involved. It's absolute chaos back there. If you've ever seen any videos of the suitcases in the airport.
Yeah.
But they get to you because it's mathematics, accounting, automation, all those things work. That's based on hyper-efficiency and economies of scale. Now you get onto the plane. Now the plane is built for a complex world, not a complicated one. In other words, you have no idea what's coming up when you're flying. You don't know if another plane's coming towards you. You don't know if a bird's going to fly into your engine. So what happens? They've built the plane with four engines when one is enough. They've got three pilots when one is enough. They've got five operating systems when one is enough. And now we see that flying is the safest way for humans to get anywhere from point A to point B. So planes are built for complexity. Conveyor belts are built for complications. And so the world we're moving into is complex. You cannot rely on what you used to have and extrapolate it into the future. You have to be incredibly adaptable, and you have to be incredibly wise to be able to let go, to relearn. And that takes a lot of maturity. And the people that are taking the most strain are the ones who don't want to let go of those identities and those old ideas of success. And this COVID-19 is started off as a virus, but it's mutated into a socioeconomic disruption like we've never seen before. It's quite clear that we're moving from the industrial world to the quantum world as this is happening in rapid pace. In fact, I used a line in the back of my book. It said, the future arrived sooner than any of us expected it to. And that's exactly what's happened.
011-883-0702-021-446-0567. John Sinai is my guest. And John, the question then becomes, are our institutions of learning, are our traditions, are our, and by the way, when I say institutions of learning, somebody immediately thinks school or university, but I'm talking even about our cultural institutions of learning, the way that mom and grandma has taught you how to think about things. Are we ready for this quantum reality? Are we ready for this world that requires an application of wisdom rather than just knowledge? Are we ready for this world that is not just complicated, but that is complex? Do we have the institutional wherewithal to teach not only individuals, but organizations to understand the nimbleness that is going to be required, the agility that is going to be required, the complexity of mind and wisdom that's going to be required in this new world that is now here?
So understand this, that we are in a space at the moment where every institution is being questioned. It's not just education. It's every single thing that we have trusted implicitly for the last 100 years we are questioning. Now, there's a great book. It's called The Fourth Turning. And in it, what they do is they're made up of historians and anthropologists, and they've studied back to the 1600s, and they've realized that humanity goes through these 80-year, 90-year cycle. They're called saeculums. And in these 80-year, 90-year cycles, there are four cycles. There's spring, summer, autumn, and winter, and they're plus minus 20 years each. And the last time we had an 80-year cycle end was World War II. It was the ending of that old world, that old ideology. And in the early 1950s, we had the beginnings of the United Nations, the Bretton Woods, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and all these new institutions in the spring of that cycle. We are now in the winter, the death and destruction of all those structures that were built up. And we can see this with the groundswells coming from people on the ground questioning the structures that we once implicitly trusted. Look at politics around the world. I'm sure you'll share the sentiment with me. Is remember when we were kids and it was 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock and my mom and dad used to say, shh,
yeah,
the news is on.
Yeah.
Because it was gospel, right?
Yeah.
Now we hardly trust in you. It's like, oh, who's saying it? Like,
yeah.
What propaganda is happening here, right? Think about religion. If the fastest growing religion in the world is no religion. Think about education. Think about the new types of medicine that are coming up. Think about Black Lives Matter. Think about the systemic racism that's been questioned. Think about the Me Too movement. Think about the systemic misogyny that was happening. Every single little thing has been turned on its head. And that's what happens at the end of a cycle. And this is where we are right now. And according to the fourth turning, the new cycle only begins in 2025 or so. So we still got a couple more years until we see the domino effects of the socioeconomic system change. And personally, I don't want to pay any disrespect to anybody who's had immense loss over this time, both with family members, friends, because I have also had loss like that, also people's businesses going up. But to be honest with you, Aubrey, we needed this. We needed a reset. You know, humanity needed to get something to pause, to relook, and to recalibrate what our futures could look like rather than just being on this overheated industrial revolution train.
011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. You speak about these movements, the Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter. These are, you know, the movement against racism, the questioning of the very idea of nationalism. These are big movements that have grown in momentum over the last 20 years. And I would agree with you that we are facing a situation of, yeah, quantum leap, not only in the way that things operate, but in consciousness, in the way that we understand and so forth. So I see what you're saying. But isn't it interesting, and I'd love to take your thoughts about this, about why it is not just things that are being done by individuals, but these are collective movements on a global scale in unprecedented ways. The Black Lives Matter movement, the Me Too movement, the rise of all of those kinds of things.
Arab Spring.
Yeah.
Keep going. There's just, look, even the royal family.
Yeah.
Even the royal family's been questioned.
Yeah. I mean, monarchy is being questioned. Yes. And you're right.
Exactly.
Why is that? Why is all of this happening in such huge numbers, in movements? And yeah, you could call them political, but they seem to have another energy about them that is perhaps not party political like we've come to understand in party politics. There's an energy to them that is biblical almost.
I agree. I really do agree. And I have one word to explain to you what it is. It's the internet. It's the internet. It's our new ability to connect on the ground without the interference of the powers that be. If you think about it, you know, we have so much propaganda thrown at us for so many years without even realizing it because we have no other option of anything else to watch, to engage with. So they manage that propaganda really well. Today, we know, we are aware that there is such a thing and that it's incredibly powerful and we're asking bigger questions about it. And so, yes, I think the movement is very much about this idea that, hang on a second, this stuff isn't fair and we have a voice and we can connect with each other to be able to begin this. And look, it always starts with one person. And then that one person multiplies and is exponential because of the exponentiality of digitization. You know, everything that has a digital sort of button attached to it becomes exponential overnight. So think about how many cameras you have on your phone. I mean, cameras, how many photos you have on your phone, how many phone calls and messages you can send. All of these are because of the digitization of it. And so now because we can communicate for free and we can see that there's other tribes of people around the world that are sharing our pain, now we've got a movement and now we can start connecting. And, you know, if you watch any time Zimbabwe has a problem, what do? They switch off WhatsApp and Facebook. Why? Because of communication. That's all it is. So the power for more than ever before in humanity, the power is now with the man on the street, the woman on the street. And this is the movement that is toppling the powers that be. And so you have this nationalism that's happening around the world with these strongmen presidents that are desperate to hold on to their power. It's just the last throes of them really holding on. So I do think that we are still in the birth canal. I do think that we haven't been rebirthed yet. I think humanity is still going through a lot of pain, and we still need to feel a lot of pain. We still need to feel the implosion of many of these systems that are really rubbish, to be honest. You know, when we think about, you know, just think about 150 years ago, slavery was the norm. 100 years ago, no woman voted.
Yeah.
40 years ago, we had children working inside factories. 30 years ago, we had apartheid. I mean, all of these things, when you think back on them, are just ridiculous and disgusting. And so it's time that they pop and implode, and we start the new world. And I really do believe that we have a new renaissance and a new spring on the way, and I'm really excited about it.
His new book is called Future Next, and he deals with some of these issues that we're talking about in that book. Would that be true, John? I would imagine. I haven't read the book yet, but some of the issues that you and I are talking about, are they part of what the contents of Future Next is about?
So what happened with Future Next is I wrote it over COVID. And the reason I started writing is that many of my clients started asking me to go back to normal. And I was so upset by that because I said, you know, why are you wanting to go back to normal? Normal was terrible. Why don't we spend this time to reimagine something new? And the problem is that we are addicted to certainty as a society. And because of that addiction... We've switched off our reimagination power. So we are much more focused on our past and dragging that identity and painful memories with us than we are reimagining something new. And so I started writing the book to say, look, instead of trying to go back to normal, let's reimagine. And so the first part of the book is about the mental tools that we could utilize to become more comfortable with uncertainty. And I can take you through one or two of them.
Sure.
The second part of the book is about reimagining a new socioeconomic system that is more fair, that is more transparent, that is just really something that's more in line with where we're going based on the digital abundant world that we're going to, not based on a linear, scarce world where we come from. And as I was writing the second part of the book, I realized that I'm not an economist. So I asked Dr. Iraj Abadian, who's a family friend, to read that part for me. And he loved what I read. He loved what he read. And he said to me, look, I'd love to write it with you. There's a couple things that you've made a mistake on here. And I said, look, that's exactly why I've invited you to come, because I'm not an economist. So together we wrote the second and the third part of the book. And so the third part of the book is some action points that we can all become participants of this future. So we use action points from an entrepreneur, a citizen, an employee, an employer, a policymaker. So what are the action points that we need to take? As a consumer, for example, as a consumer, we are all activists. We can all choose where we want to put our money, what conversations to have. As an employee, you have an opportunity to work for organizations that you have a value connection. As an employer, you can prioritize community and employees and manage your shareholders, which is something that's going on around the world quite a lot. So the book is really about what do we do in the future next? How do we reimagine the world ahead of us? And how do we conquer uncertainty so we're comfortable with it rather than so scared of it?
011-883-0702. Join me as I speak to best-selling author, global trend specialist, business innovation strategist, John Sine. And we're talking about a whole bunch of things. Love for you to talk to us and bring your thoughts to the conversation on 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567. You spoke earlier on about the merging of future business strategies and tools with ideas that are ancient, ideas that have that are not strange, that are not, and that suggests to me a new language, John. That that, for example, we know thou shalt not steal. We know that there is value in sharing and understanding the power of community. We understand all of these things, and these aren't new things. These are ancient understandings. But of course, there are new tools. There are new applications of those old ideas. That suggests to me that we need a new language that incorporates both the new and the old. Have we developed it?
Not yet. We are in the process of doing it, and it's a maturing of our consciousness. Remember that our society has prioritized left-brain logical thinking over everything else for the last 200 years. It's always been about the degree, as you spoke about, what you know, how are you applying it, how much money can you make, and that's always been the drive. We are now starting to realize that no matter how much money you have, you just may be a miserable person. And we have now switched to starting to realize, how do we prioritize different things? How do we recreate the idea of success? And we're already starting to see that the younger generation, the Gen Zs and some of the millennials, have definitely started to see this in a very different way. Their priorities have changed. And if you think about it, our fathers would work in one job their whole lives, maybe even very miserably, but just to be able to provide for the family to get to pension. now we have these younger generation that, you know, jump jobs, they start their own thing, they're living all over, working from a laptop. They've already redefined success in many ways. And so what we have to start doing is realizing that the old ways that we've been doing things have always been great for the old world. And we have to have a redefinition of success. And this is what the ancient truths and the future strategies look like, is how do we create more conscious and seamless lives rather than just the chase towards this elusive money of this elusive goal of more money, which sometimes you realize that when you make a million, you're so unhappy because you want two, and you make two, and it's four, and it's four, and it's eight. You just, you never end, and you're always on this chase. And it's just a sad place to be, because you can die rich and very unhappy. And what's the point of that?
Let's take a call from Roger in Edenvale. Hi, Roger.
Hi, John.
Yeah, go for it.
Aubrey.
Hello, yeah, go for it.
Evening, Aubrey and John. I just wanted to say, you know, within 10 years, 80% of work commuters will be using PJPs. Currently, people are using PJPs, but undercover around the world in various countries. Private jetpacks. Now, when I invented the world's first air running shoe, I accommodated, you know, my shoe encompasses replaceable tubes, you know, that you pump up. So, I mean, this helps with the impact of PJPs. I reckon within about 5 years' time, Elon Musk will probably start a private jetpack company, you know? People are using PJPs, you know, in various countries.
Just help me understand, Roger. I'm unfamiliar with PJPs. Well, what is that?
Private jetpacks. Look, currently an Italian guy invented a private jetpack that works just on the compressed air and a battery. And I mean, other people are using sort of microjets to sort of fly to work. I mean, I know at least five guys that are currently using PJPs to fly to work. You know, though, you know, a lot of people work from home.
So it's like those rockets you put on your back and you just chuck, you go to work.
Exactly. This is it.
I like it. All right, Roger in Edenvale, much appreciated. Are you using a PJP, John?
And not yet, but I have seen, you know, I'm a faculty member at Singularity University, and there was a Singularity University summit in Kyalami, and there was a guy there flying one, flying it all around Kyalami, actually the whole track. It was really impressive to watch, and it almost reminds you of like James Bond, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, those things will start coming. I mean, look, every aspect of our lives has been digitized and changed, and everything from transport to education to healthcare, you know. So, yes, PJPs, it's funny that he just came up with PJPs, but yeah, they are happening. It's a good call, and I'm sure that Elon Musk will be pumping them out real soon too. I think he's spot on from Edenvale.
Yeah, and I suppose that's a cue for me to bring the conversation down to recognizable applications of some of the things that you and I have been talking about. I think maybe we've been a little cerebral in the way that we've been having the conversation. Let's bring it down a little bit.
Sure.
One of the things that I let me start off by saying, what are some of the things that you have been looking at just in terms of practical application of the new way of thinking that you believe is ready for pickings? In other words, it's low hanging fruit that can exponentially help us in understanding the way we need to start thinking now in order for us to be relevant in the very near future. In other words, when we get born, as we move into, you know, as we move more and more, as life's peristaltic movements take us to the birth canal, if you understand what I'm trying to say, what are some of those low-hanging fruits in real life that you are seeing now that my listeners and myself would be able to recognize in the application of this way of thinking?
So there's two flows of business that I've been tracking. And important to understand them, because if you are going to be servicing clients or building a business, it's important to understand these two sets of flows. The first one is about 25 years ago, we went through the process of globalization, and it was the big buzzword, and everybody was about becoming global. And that was really great for the economy, and it grew. And then the internet arrived and we started focusing on the sort of the digitization flow of business, and everything was about digital first, and the whole world moved into that digital world. Today, we're starting to see a brand new flow, and the new flow is called dispersion. And dispersion is this idea that everything that we used to congregate in is being dispersed. In other words, head offices, education institutions, hospitals, restaurants, all of these things that we used to congregate in are now being dispersed out of those congregations. So we're seeing a de-urbanization move. We're starting to see a massive move around DIY, home offices, telemedicine, education from home. And if you are in any of those sectors, you need to realize that everything is shifting to becoming dispersed. So that's the first one. Does that make sense?
Do you want it me to does. So you, no. I want you to unpack it a little more, but I'm going to try and paraphrase to see if I understand what you're saying. That there is a decentralization of ideas.
There is a
move to creating far more fluid, far more nimble institutions and ways of thinking and ways of doing. That centralized power in the hands of the individual rather than the head office.
There we go.
The implication, though, of that, John, is quite profound then, yeah?
Yes. Well, here's the thing. There's pros and cons, right?
Yeah.
The pros are that you can live in nature and can work anywhere in the world. The pro is that you can work for any organization around the world. The pro is that you can earn any income.
Right.
Any currency from around the world. There's many pros.
Yeah.
And I think that we can see that with these, they're called second cities that are starting to grow around the world. So these cities around the world weren't the capital cities. They were the cities just outside of the capitals. For example, in Switzerland, there's a city called Lausanne. And Lausanne now is becoming a very popular city because it's 45 minutes away from the airport. It's around nature. A lot of executives are starting to live there because they don't need to live in Geneva because it's too expensive. And you can see the mass migration down to Cape Town as well, with so many people coming to Cape Town because they don't need to be in Joburg as they used to be before. So there's lots of pros around these. You spend more time with your family. You spend more time.
That's what happened with Sandton, isn't it? I mean, Sandton became Lausanne a couple of decades ago when Joburg was the CBD, and look at Sandton, yeah?
That's it, exactly. So people have moved out of Sandton. Now, the negative, there's a big negative, is that we are more isolated than a living being. We are not mixing with people from different levels of society. We're being more segregated. And we can see this with the Minister of Loneliness that's been appointed in Japan and the Minister of Loneliness that's been appointed in England.
Sure.
Because of the massive number of suicides that are happening. I'm sure you remember, I mean, I definitely remember going to school, my mom dropping us off at school, and I would look to the car next to me, and the person was singing the same song we were singing because I was listening to Radio 5 or Metro. That's gone.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Folks are listening to podcasts.
There's less
broadcasting and more narrowcasting. That's it.
So we realize that the happiest cities and countries around the world are always the ones that spend enough time and more time with people around them. And I'll give you one stat. Denmark is supposed to be one of the happiest countries in the world. And Denmark, everybody in Denmark, it belongs to 3.4 different types of groups. And let me explain that. On a Tuesday, you meet for sauna. On Wednesday, you meet for knitting. On a Saturday, you meet for hiking. And so in Denmark, people belong to common ground groups more than any other country in the world. And that is what makes them the happiest. And so the downside of this is loneliness. The downside of this is segregation. And so this is a new challenge that we're going to be having moving forward, is the deep levels of loneliness and happiness in this process of individuality and having your opportunity to listen to what you need to listen to. So, yes, dispersion is both great because pollution is slowing down. We don't have all that traffic that we have to sit in. But there's also a downside. So that's the first sort of trend and sort of global move that I've started to see happen. Should I get on to the second one?
But before you do, it's going to create different kinds of tribes. And by the way, I'm not talking about ethnic groups here. I'm talking about you know, people with a particularly common way of thinking. And I suppose, John, that is why you are beginning to see the questioning of age-old institutions such as monarchs. The questioning of the very ideas that have kept them together is being seen by the moves of individuals such as Harry and his wife, Angela Merkel. I mean, that conversation seems to be a manifestation of exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. We're moving away from those old structures, you know? It's got its pros and cons. Like everything, you know?
Yep.
Everything's got a duality in our lives, you know? Some people are, you know, the future is going to be great and bad for a lot of people. It's like, it's just, you have to choose what you want, you know? You have to choose your heart, as they say.
Yeah.
It's going to be hard in both ways.
Give me the second one.
So let's talk about the second trend that I've been watching. Again, a massive flow, a massive change. And we can see this in the social media apps that are growing. So we went from brick and mortar to digital. And that was a big move. And now what we've done is we've gone from digital to virtual. In other words, we have so much digital content that we don't actually listen to any of it anymore. You know, how many podcasts are there and how many YouTube channels are there? And we don't watch things from the past. We want things cutting edge. We want them live. And so we see Clubhouse is a live version of podcasts. So now all of a sudden Clubhouse is the hot thing. TikTok is a live version of Instagram. And so we're starting to see this move towards much more live and virtual engagements with people. You know, how many courses do we have online in Coursera and all those course-based websites that you can go and sign up for a course? Do you know what the completion rate for one of those courses is? That's only like 6%. It's ridiculous. It's like nobody even does those things because there's such an abundance of it. We want live. We want virtual. And so we've seen that many online businesses are taking a lot of strain. And what they are is not a bad business. It's just that they're digital and static and boring. And we have become very, very spoiled as consumers. We want it now. We want it hot. And we want it to be as virtual and live as possible.
Oh, all right. And I suppose the question then becomes, are our aspirations? Yeah. The aspirations that we have for our families, for our children, for our communities, are they relevant for this tide of reality that's coming our way? If I'm still thinking, oh, I want my little Johnny to go to university and get a degree, if I'm still thinking in terms of, oh, I want my daughter to meet a nice boy and get married and live forever happily forever, are our aspirations still relevant for the future that we're walking into?
Or that
we are turboing into. Sorry, John.
Yeah. We're moving at hyper pace towards uncertainty. That's the tough thing, you know. We're moving at speed and nobody knows where. So here's the thing. I call this the Goldilocks effect. You know, the porridge is not too hot, not too cold, just perfect.
Yep.
And let me ask you this, Aubrey. When you're on the highway and somebody zooms past you at 200 kilometers an hour, what do you think? You think this person is a danger to the world.
He's probably driving a BMW. I'm joking. Easy BMW drivers.
They've got this new feature. No, have you seen the BMWs? They've got this new feature. It's called an indicator.
Yeah.
It just arrived. So we're hoping that they start using it. Just kidding. I used to have a BMW myself.
I love BMW. Hey, guys, don't kill me, all right? John and I don't hate BMW. We love BMW. Yeah, no, and we love BMW drivers, too.
Whew. Yeah. Okay. So when you're on the highway, some guy zooms past you at 200, you think to yourself, what a menace to society. Anybody going slower than you, you think this person's just a danger to the roads.
Yeah.
Who's going the best speed? You.
Yeah.
Only you. You going the perfect speed. Anybody faster, anybody slower is a danger to the road. Right. That's how we always feel. And so what we're doing is that our parents have got all the best intentions in the world, but they're applying their temperature of porridge to the future. They're applying their speed of the world to the future. And our grandmothers freaked out when there were televisions being brought into the lounge because they said, this is the end of family life. Today, it's a cell phone. Tomorrow, it'll be something else. And so every generation is always freaking about the next generation, that they're all getting it wrong because we had it right. And we must realize that the speed of the world that we're moving into is just totally different to the world we come from. So going into university, and I say this with caution, because I do think that any different degrees are necessary, like being a doctor or like being an accountant. There's certain engineers, you know, those are necessary. But realizing that learning a specific way of thinking for 4 to 6 years and then the world changes around you, that is the worst thing you could do for your kids.
Yeah, you remind me. I'm a big fan of the work of Khalil Gibran, and in his meditations in the Prophet, he speaks of children. He says, "Your children are not yours; they are life's longing after itself. They come not from you, but through you. They are going to a place that you cannot visit, not even in your dreams." John Sinead, I want to take a quick break. When I come back, I want to ask you what you're reading now. Please stand by and let's take this quick break. 702.
The Aubrey Masango Show. Live, online. Smartphones, DSTV. 92.7. And 106 FM.
John Sinead is my guest, and we're talking about some of the ideas that he has been thinking about, working on, and he's written the book Future Next, and I'm hoping that you will get it for yourself, because folks, the future is here, and we better be ready. John, if somebody's been listening to this conversation and their heads are spinning right now, thinking, wow, where do they start to center themselves, to start the journey of being relevant for the time that we are turboing into now?
Very good question. You know, we spend very little time exploring the possibilities and probable futures that are coming. And because of that, it's dark, it's uncertain, so we're scared of it and we avoid it. And the suggestion I always give to my clients is, why don't you make every Thursday morning, 1 hour in the morning, your morning to look at the future and just discuss it and watch something and just engage with it. And what this slowly does, it changes your language, it changes your focus point, you become more familiar with the future. And so many people are just stuck in operations, head down, and just like focusing on survival. And really, that doesn't give them the opportunity to be more creative and to reimagine. So for me, it's a three-pronged approach, you know. We are our perspective, and our perspective is made up of our state, and our state is made up of our emotional state, our mental state, and our physical state. It's very difficult to be excited about the future when you're carrying heavy emotional stuff. It's very difficult to think about the future and reimagine when your mind is full of yesterday's ideas. And it's difficult to think about the future energetically if your body is not one that's ready to move and to be engaging and flexible and healthy. So it really becomes our responsibility to prepare for this future on as many different fronts as possible. And so if your head is spinning, I'm sorry that it is, but it's not the point. The point is to try and get you a little bit scared, but 90% inspired to step up and expose yourself to the future. Because everything I've spoken to you about today, I've got it off books and internet and self-educated. You know, it's not something that's secretly locked away in the vault, you know.
John Sinead, what are you reading right now?
I'm reading a book called Think Again by Adam Grant.
Say that again.
Who is. Think Again by Adam Grant. And what he is an organizational psychologist. And, the Obamas have written about him, Brené Brown, Bill and Melinda Gates. And so what he really wants to do is wants us to become better rethinkers. He says, don't slow down your thinking. Get better at rethinking. And so very much in line with my work is like, how do we become better rethinkers? How do we get past our assumptions and biases? And all of us have them. So this is what I do with organizations. You know, I go in and I speak to the leaders, and the biggest thing I can do for leaders is to become and make them aware of the assumptions and biases. And we all carry them, you know. We have many different biases that we carry. For example, change is bad. That's a bias. You know, some people love change. Or you have confirmation bias. You only speak to people that think like you do.
Yeah.
So anything you think, you keep confirming to yourself it's right.
John, got to stop you because I've got to take the news. And how do people get Future Next?
Exclusive books, Amazon, Take a Lot, Loot, it's all over the place. So if you're looking for it, please do go and get it. It'll be wonderful for you to share the journey with us.
My brother, it's been great talking to you. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Great
stuff. Thank you, Aubrey.
John Sinead, best-selling author, global trend specialist.